Ragtime is an aggressively relevant 1998 musical with music by Stephen Flaherty, lyrics by Lynn Ahrens, and a book by Terex McNally. It tells the story of three groups in the United States in the earliest 20th century, African Americans, upper-class suburban whites, and Eastern European immigrants, through the intersecting stories and lives of three families. My guest today is writer and podcaster Moises Chuyon. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Ragtime. Hi, Moises.
Hello, Quinn. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm going to try to not like ugly cry at any point talking about this show.
Honestly, you might get our download numbers up. Like, feel free to have the emotion.
Yeah, I picked a show that I've been in, not because I've been in it, but because it's especially in a post Hamilton world, it's very much about the American condition and a lot of things that a lot of people are talking about pretty intently as we speak. And it surprises me that more people don't know it, especially post Hamilton, because there is that kind of interest in this sort of story that tackles these kinds of issues.
How did you discover this show? What was your experience hearing it for the first time, being in it for the first time?
I had no idea that it existed back in 2004 when a local regional theater company was doing it as their summer show. And it is a large scale musical, not just in the production values, but it's got a cast of like 50 people. It's a musical based on a book, which like there was a movie made as an adaptation of Ragtime, the book by E.L. Doctorow, but the musical takes some very intentional turns away from being an exact adaptation of the book. I knew that they needed a bunch of people. I did not know it at all. And a friend loaned me a copy of the cast recording, and I just listened to it all the way through twice. And there's a lot to absorb. There are multiple intersecting plot lines. There are multiple lead characters, and a lot of things going on. A bunch of characters actually from history. People like Harry Houdini, who I played 14 years ago, Booker T. Washington, J.P. Morgan. You know, people out there listening might have J.P. Morgan Chase bank accounts, but yeah, the literal American plutocrat himself was a character in this. Henry Ford has a song that's like an assembly line song, and the voice used in the original Broadway cast got a big laugh when we listened through to it after casting and as we were kind of walking through the show. But I didn't know the show really terribly well at all. I barely knew that it existed. I was still kind of I fell more on the scale of like, I knew older Broadway stuff much better than the more recent stuff. So, you know, I could quote you chapter and verse of Phantom or Les Mis, but I didn't know the show particularly well. You know, I haven't taken regular trips to New York to see shows. It's not something that was ever quite in the budget for, you know, the kid of public school teachers. You know, I learned shows from listening to cast recordings when I could afford them, when a friend would loan them to me, when somebody would recommend them to me, that kind of thing. But this show is so complex that it's nuts that we ended up pulling it off. Like there's a car that has to drive on stage. That's part of the whole thing, is there is an actual like Model T style car that you drive around. And for years after our production, our company was making money renting out the car and shipping it around to different regional theater companies across the country, because we figured out a way to make it work. So yeah, I didn't know the show particularly well. I didn't know Flaherty and Ahrens, their work at all. And it was a, you should audition for this. There's probably something in there for you. And then after we did our initial wave of stuff in the auditions, the director who I'd worked with a number of times, he was like a producer on a few different shows that I'd been in, came up to me and he said, how are you with heights? And
it's
I said,
ominous.
Why does that matter? And he said, well, cause Harry Houdini, enters, suspended by his ankles in a straight jacket, spinning around in circles. And I said, well, that's, okay, sure. Why not? I'm sure that's fine. And I didn't really have to, face up to the physical demands of, suspending myself by a trapeze during the opening curtain speech and the 10 minutes or so, after that it took to actually get to the point where Houdini enters, you know, getting himself out of a straitjacket. And it was a sweatshirt with holes in the sleeves. So it wasn't that complex, but it was still a matter of lowering myself off of a trapeze, straight up and down so that I wasn't swinging around as I was spinning around in circles. So it was the greatest, entrance I will ever get as an actor. It was, you know, the historical parts in the show are, among the smaller ones, but they're also among the more fun. And being able to just be a part of it, felt significant and like a big deal. When you're doing a big show like this, this was actually the first time that company had experimented with taking the orchestra and putting them off stage in the auxiliary room off to the side. And so the conductor was video conference beamed onto a projection screen, like up in the back of the projection booth. So we were taking our cues from the conductor, from an abnormal place. And we had, people like going into this side room to sing chorus parts for different things that they weren't on stage for, just to like boost the vocal strength of chorus numbers. So there were Harlem numbers that I sang on. There were immigrant, numbers I sang on. There were stuffy white people, numbers that I sang on. It was the most incredible production I've ever been a part of. And that's not even getting into all the ugly crying stuff.
I'm so impressed to hear like some of the strategies of being able to pull this off in a local theater setting. I mean, this is a show that it ran for over 800 performances and it still wasn't considered financially successful because it was just such a huge production that it was mm-hmm. so expensive for the Broadway cast.
Yeah, it is. You really have an army of a cast. It's not exaggerating to say it's a cast of like 50 people. It really is. I mean, just the historical figure people, that's like 10 or 12 people. And those roles end up doubling into other things. You know, the first mate of the ship early on ends up being one of the Harlem dancers. You know, Harry Caythaw doubled as Harry Conklin. It is a massive undertaking. And the interesting thing though is depending on the part, you know, you spend an extended amount of time off stage. And so once everybody got really well settled in, you know, you would find yourself figuring out that, you know, in my case, I had a bunch of overlapping time with Emma Goldman, who I ended up casting in a show that I was directing about 3 months later. And she was just like plowing her way through books because she had so much time off stage. When she was on stage, it was like, I mean, it was go time. It was, you know, putting in your star, sports ball player. But, she spent a lot of time just sitting around backstage, and just kind of, you know, hanging out. And so you got the initial phase of getting to know people that you were doing a bunch of scenes with. And then once we were actually getting into doing runs of the show, It was a matter of who did you have a bunch of free time just kind of hanging out, killing time with. And, you know, you could, it was almost like we were like programmed robots that would be waiting for a signal tone from the orchestra, and it'd be like, oh, gotta go, be right back. I need to go, put myself in a purple, spandex suit for the Atlantic City number.
The only comparison I can think for that is because while I was listening to it, I kept thinking about these pop-ups of the historical characters reminded me of King George and Hamilton, who was barely in the rest of the show except for one or two scenes, but just pops up to do his songs throughout.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, actually, the Atlantic City number is a good example of it, where the brilliant thing about it is there are songs in it that people go, oh, I don't really like the baseball one. Oh, I don't really like this one. Oh, I don't really like this one. Not only did they have to find a way to create time to stage the next big, huge, you know, 24-person dance number, but there are moments that highlight the level of entitlement of the New Rochelle people, that gives more context to what is going on and isn't just a means of wasting time necessarily. When things really get crazy and hairy in the second act, you know, you've got a friggin' baseball number. But it does a fair amount of further groundwork laying of this is what the atmosphere was like. This is how difficult just the concept of civil rights was for a lot of people to absorb. There is that kind of King George and Hamilton bit of, oh, hey, we're going to check in again with Evelyn Nesbitt and Harry Houdini. They're both horrible, giant mental wrecks, and they're going to live very unhappy rest of their lives. But who cares? They're action figures from history. History, history.
Before we get too deep into the weeds, I also want to go back and just say, I think it was funny when you said you didn't know this show very well because you were more familiar with older theater, which is, I didn't really know this show, but from the other direction, whereas like, in 2004, this was pretty new, whereas now it's 20 years old, and I didn't know this show because I know a lot more recent theater. So it is funny, the ceaseless march of time.
But yeah, it's one that I feel like more people should know. It got revived about 10 years ago, I think. But just being revived on Broadway doesn't give you the kind of exposure that makes everybody as aware that it exists as, say, something like Little Shop, something that has a movie attached to it. And if somebody eventually does a musical movie of this, that's what I think it'll take. Because it has the reputation in the community, of being this, oh, this is, I mean, go and see Ragtime. And if you are lucky enough to be somewhere that is doing a production of it, it will change your life. It's amazing. And I think it's amazing that the show started in Toronto. A quintessentially American musical started outside the States in tryout, and only eventually made its way to Broadway.
That is an interesting trajectory. I didn't even realize that when I was first looking into it, that it didn't actually start on Broadway. And it's also the more that I learn about this show, the more I am surprised it is not a more front and center. I didn't really know it. The only thing that I knew about it was the song New Music, which I only knew because we performed in my show choir last year.
Yeah.
And we were all very confused because, like,
when you don't... His fingers stroke those... says turn my way. It's really confusing. It's a beautiful song. It's really confusing out of context.
Yeah, because we knew nothing, and like all of the character names were labeled, but like didn't make any sense if you don't know the plot. And
younger brother, but what's his name? yeah but what's the guy's name? Third base. it can be really, really confusing. And I found myself trying to explain it to a friend earlier today, as I said, yeah, I'm going to go on this podcast and talk about this amazing show that it's bizarre that it seems like, you know, nobody has still heard of. And it opens with father and mother and this guy named Tata and what? And it's got a cast of like 40 something people. You know, good luck.
Yeah, it's about these three different families, but also the American dream, but also every famous historical figure from the early 20th century, but also everything else.
Yeah, it opens with this tableau of stuffy, rich white people in like bonnets and hats and parasols and tennis pants, you know, talking about being privileged and rich and, oh gosh, everything sure is just great. Gee golly willikers. And then all of a sudden, here come the people of Harlem. And there's this piano player guy. And, oh, look, it's Booker T. Washington. Where did Booker T. Washington come from? And oh, no, here immigrants from Eastern Europe. And look, there's socialist anarchist Emma Goldman. What's she doing here? And, you know, here's vaudeville tart Evelyn Nesbitt. Which somebody will probably assail me for daring call her a tart, but that was how she marketed herself. So, you know, that very, very on brand. It follows the three big threads of the New Rochelle people, where most of the character development surrounds the mother of this family, whose character arc is very much, oh, I do have free will. Golly. Huh.
How about that?
Interesting how that works. The father of the family is completely blind to everything other than the fact that, well, gosh, I'm a bearded rich white man who makes his money in fireworks. I figure I'll go get on a ship and go be a rich man. Toodles. Bye, 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 everybody. The mother's younger brother, who is trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life other than be obsessed with Evelyn Nesbitt. And her little son, Edgar, who opens the show playing a Victrola. And the kid who played Edgar in our production is now this like super ripped, like blonde Adonis. Like he would be Rocky in the Rocky Horror Show.
Oh, God.
Easily. And at the time he was this, like, he was this mop headed little platinum blonde kid who, the show opens with this spotlight on this little blonde kid cranking a Victrola. And he was our little possessed child of the corn. And it's what the hell is this? I thought I was going to see some big scale musical and there's a kid playing a record player. Huh? And then over the next 15 minutes, the cast of thousands, as it were, eventually forms up on the stage in three wedges. And the opening number, by the time you get to the glorious chants of ragtime, 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 then you get an impression of, oh, this is huge. It's not just going to tell one of these stories and everything else is window dressing. It's telling three main stories layered on top of each other with a bunch of other stuff on top of that. You've got three musicals worth of great songs stacked on top of each other. And the other thing about this is, like, depending on what version of a cast recording you find, there's a concept cast recording that has songs in it that never made it to the final version. There's the original Broadway cast recording. And then in the 2009 revival, they shortened a bunch of the songs, which I think was actually probably a good idea. Because at the point that you could, adapt to the staging, not needing the extra time for people to rapidly change costumes and fly in big set pieces and that kind of thing. Some of the songs can wear out their welcome. You know, the Henry Ford song is cute, but I don't know if it's 4 minutes cute. It's difficult to say that, you know, like something like Les Mis or Phantom, that two people's experiences of it are the exact same. Even in the Broadway cast recording, there's a bit at the beginning of Act Two, with Harry Houdini and Edgar the little boy that doesn't exist in regional theater stagings. I think partly because it involves like an exploding box escape trick, and there were concerns about liability, and so a lot of people just didn't stage it that way. it was completely excised from the revival. And they just started with Edgar the little boy having a vision that something terrible was going to happen. Oh God. So, this is how easy it is to get tripped up, just trying to do something as straightforward as, oh, these are the central characters. Here you go. So let's see, there's the family New Rochelle. And then in the opening number, they introduce, the people of Harlem led by Cole House Walker Jr., who in the Broadway cast was played by Brian Stokes Mitchell, one of the legendary greatest, vocalists in Broadway history. Mm-hmm. He's a piano player. He's the titular ragtime guy, in the show. And he has fallen for this beautiful woman named Sarah, and he's not exactly the best dude. You know, to paraphrase Hamilton, I mean, how would he say no to this? You know, he just couldn't resist, So there's some tension there. Again, you know, we have historical figure Booker T. Washington pop in, and talk about how he's the most famous, man of color in the country, and blah, blah, blah. And that'll be important later. And then we come to the immigrants of Eastern Europe, led by Tata, this guy who is widowed, with a small daughter in the original cast, played by Lea Michele of Glee and many other things fame. And they're just trying to make their way, and they're escaping, bad stuff in Latvia, and they're gonna find their way in this beautiful new country. They're surrounded by many, many other people, that just want an opportunity at a better life. And, there's a lot of the Harlem thread, the Eastern European immigrant threads that play directly into current, you know, Black Lives Matter, peaceful protest, you know, civil rights stuff that's happening, immigrant rights stuff that's happening for people of all colors and creeds. If there were a production of this show up on Broadway right now, man alive, you know, people would be fighting it out between this and Hamilton, because it is all so directly relevant. The notion of somebody, fighting and scraping and working really hard, like Cole House does, and that not being good enough for some casual racist who think that it is just fine to just screw with somebody and destroy their property and, you know, get a sense of humor. And there's no sense of humor to be had about people feeling the entitlement that they are better than somebody else. If there is an overall central theme, beyond all of the historical context, all of the individual character threads, it's about the right of everybody to be allowed to find their way in the world and not be unfairly prejudiced against, that nobody is more equal than somebody else. Everybody deserves as much of a shot as any other person does.
It's about this idea of the American dream and like what that actually means when like an immigrant comes here in search of that, and what do they find, and like, is the idea of the American dream a false prophecy, or is it like the ultimate ideal that we should be striving for? Where does it fall? And all of the characters experience this in different ways throughout the show.
Yeah, it's something that that is a realization for some people. For some people, it's something that they know and that they are passionately, deeply to the bottom of their soul, trying to get other people to understand. You know, Kohlhaas himself is very much the messenger of the American dream of no, this is who we are. This is what we're, this is what people have fought for. This is what people have died for. This is why this country is so great. This is why people want to be here. This is not something that we need to relitigate, as it were. This is just the way that America works, and this is the way that America should work. And you know, damn anybody who tells you otherwise.
But then Kohlhaas ends up being one of the people, perhaps the person who suffers the most at the hands of this falling down around him. And I think with that, we will let the spoiler horn go off to talk about what happens to these characters as they're trying to pursue the American dream. It's really sad, actually.
Yeah. A lot of things explode. People are shot. Things are burned down. Mass anarchy. It's basically like the scale of it is such that I found myself hanging out with, you know, the weird thing about the way that the show is set up with the three different groups is that people would kind of sort into those groups like houses at Hogwarts. And I kind of ended up blending between the Eastern European immigrant, folks and the Harlem folks. Because I ended up having more scenes with pretty much the two of them and never interacted with the New Rochelle people, with I think maybe one exception or something. And it is not to undercut the tragedy of it or anything, but the way that you deal with it is, you know, in final like timing run throughs and cue rehearsals for tech and everything, the melodramatic deaths and the in some cases extremely melodramatic prose written into the dialogue you know, of Kohlhaas's Sarah you know, declaring that, and then President, I'm gonna say this, and oh President, I'm gonna say that. The actress playing that just found that hilarious, because she's as meaningful as the character is and everything, she is really written as this really dopey, dumb, sacrificial lamb outside of the transcendent, amazing, glorious ballads that she gets to sing. So when it comes down to the, you know, her fate toward the end of Act One, she's just like, oh, I'm dead now. Okay. the woman who played Sarah's friend in our production, she decided that she had a name, and her name is Shaniqua, and Shaniqua gonna sing at the end of Act One and tell everybody, you know, what's going on. It is such a heavy show that even as melodramatic as, if you just listen to the cast recording, there are bits that really do, they're deeply emotional and sad and tragic, but they also come off just, I mean, like vaudeville melodrama level. And that's part of the way the whole show is staged. But I feel like it can unintentionally come off as the show being a bit flip about, you know, the mortality of different people. And at the same time, you know, can be a bit much and a bit preachy or something, but, you know, it's give and take with musical theater. It's ridiculous that everybody's singing and dancing and doing dialogue, and nobody's talking about the fact that everybody's singing half of their dialogue.
Well, with the music in this as well, like, I mean, there are some musicals where it's expressed through music, but the music itself doesn't have a lot to do with the story. Whereas here, I mean, the show is literally called Ragtime, and all of the music is the metaphor at the same time that it is a means of expression.
Yeah, when Kohlhaas and Sarah come back together in Act One and sing Wheels of a Dream together, it just... just talking about it makes me cry. But listening to people sing that song, you feel it vibrate through your core, and it just reduces you to a puddle of a mess of tears. Enough,
I will show him America, and he will ride on the wheels of a dream.
And usually in a show, you are doing the thing where you're sitting there reading. And in this show, most of the time that we would do that was going to be in Act Two, because there was more of everybody kind of moving in and out and overlapping, you know, one number into the next in Act One. And there were numbers like Wheels of Dream that just absolutely destroy you, that are absolutely beautiful, and all about the American dream and all about the promise of America, where Cole House and Sarah have had this kid. He discovers that they had this kid after trying to track her down and having done her wrong. And this is them healing that bond, and talking about and looking to the future and the promise of America to come for him. And, you know, it is one of those songs that you cannot see people perform enough, that you're in a production of this and you've seen people rehearsing it for months and you're still going, I'll finish doing my, you know, second costume in a minute. It's what, a cummerbund? Fine, whatever. That'll take 2 seconds. I'm going to watch Chris and Francis sing this song and reduce me to tears and hug somebody that I still barely know, who's dressed up as like a showgirl from the vaudeville number with Evelyn Nesbitt. It's a show that just wears all of its hearts on its sleeve, especially for those really deeply meaningful songs.
This is a side note, because I mean, this song stands on itself regardless of performer, but also shout out to Audra McDonald for being the original Broadway, Sarah, which she won one of her 6 Tonys for this part. So,
yeah. And I had not mentioned her yet, in particular, because just, you know, when they bring her on to like sing something for the Kennedy Center Honors or PBS 4th of July or something, like just when she's just randomly on something or she's on Colbert singing a song from some show that she's in, it just, seeing her reduces me to tears, because I've listened to this cast recording so many times, and the songs that I never skip are the ones that she's on, her and Stokes. And some of Stokes' stuff in the second act, it isn't as good, easy listening. But their duet numbers are, they melt you. Like you're a puddle. It's ridiculous. They are parts that, you know, people of my admittedly off-white skin tone, you know, would never play, but just singing along to them in the car, you know, you're stopped at a stoplight and bawling your way through singing through a song, every single time. I feel like in the workshopping process, these songs would not be as good as they were if it weren't those two performers that they had working on them, because I'm sure that there's stuff that was cut out of and shaved off of these songs. And you look at the list of stuff that was curtailed and changed and altered, going into, the 2009 revival, and none of it are the Cole House and Sarah numbers. They stay the exact same, absolutely the exact same. And they're absolutely airtight and solid. And you could just play the Cole House and Sarah, numbers together as like a concert performance, and they would hang together just fine.
That would be, wait, what is their last song? That'd be a sad, be a sad story.
Well, the thing that really sells it is, one of the things that my first time listening to it, I didn't quite get was, wait a minute, did I miss something? Hold on. I feel like I just met these people and now they're on the rocks and what's going on? And it felt like their relationship was just kind of shorthanded. And then when you get to Sarah Brown Eyes late in Act Two, you go back in time to when Kohlhaas and Sarah, who has now been dead for the majority of an act of the show, first met. And first, it's the first couple lines kind of get you a little bit, and then you get to Kohlhaas singing, "There was no music in my heart tonight. Sweet and slow. I mean, aside from falling in love with Brian Stokes Mitchell, it triggers like a sense memory that you don't have of that kind of beautiful, passionate, lusty, delicious kind of comfort and affection that everybody always wants. That is that ideal, that is when people talk about like the newness of a relationship, that you want to hang on to, it is that concentrate just poured down your throat. And it just, you totally get it. Like if you somehow have a constitution of iron and did not feel it for these two people yet, if you don't feel it by the end of that song, you have no heart, you're racist, or both. It just like that's all there is to it. That's it. It is tender. It is delicate. It is passionate and lovely and sweet and kind. In the middle of the section of the show where everything's on fire and blowing up.
Do you think that the show would be better served if that number was sooner?
I don't think so, honestly, because you know, Wheels of a Dream. They come back to it at the end of the show, for very good reason. And that's the part where I feel like that's even if you don't know that Sarah Brown Eyes is coming, that's where you shorthand what their relationship is, what it means, and how passionate they are about each other, about the promise of their son, about the promise of the future and the American dream. And to me, if you have to actively not be paying attention to the show to not have that song get you in particular, you know, the stuff that comes before it is, you know, narrative setup for a number of things. And then we finally get to Kohlhaas Walker. And for me, I feel like it is the longest six song introduction to what the show is actually about that you could possibly have, but it's absolutely essential. You have to have all of that, window dressing for Kohlhaas's story to work. I mean, it is effectively, you know, people say, well, why isn't Harlem in the show earlier aside from the prologue? And to me, it's that you've got to roll out that big of a red carpet for the beating red heart of the show. Mm-hmm. And then it is pretty thickly all the way Kohlhaas and Sarah's show for a good long while. And, you know, you take a break for the Henry Ford number. But you have in that meaty center portion of Act One, You have to me the most emotionally important stuff. You've got the introduction to Kohlhaas. You've got him getting the car. You've got Sarah singing "Your Daddy's Son," which if you have not cried in the show yet, which it's entirely possible that you haven't, and you have not cried by the point that you have you know, on the original cast recording, Audra McDonald wailing and crying, singing to her son. You have no heart. You're a racist, or both. Just, you know, that's all there is to it. But yeah, new music is a great song, but it really is very difficult to have make any sense outside of the context of where it fits in the narrative. You know, Your Daddy's Son just plain works on its own. You know, Wheels of a Dream spins up with, I see his face, I hear his heartbeat, and you can feel yourself start to cry. And you're like, I don't know why. I don't know what he's going to say. What's happening? I look in those eyes, how wise they seem. And that's it. You're done. It is a show that if you didn't walk into it knowing that you're going to be a weeping mess multiple times, I pity you because you didn't bring enough Kleenex.
There is a version of this show that is just, or not just, but it's centered completely around Kohlhaas and Sarah, and it's their story, and everyone else is just sort of like, you put the window dressing for it. But that show isn't Ragtime. That's a different show. And like, this is like, I totally agree that like, they're the beating heart of this story. But what makes them so great, what makes the show so great, is that their story is so interweaved with everyone else's, and it's put in this incredibly rich tapestry of early 20th century America.
Yeah, there is stuff that you can shave away from the long version of the show, but you have to be careful what it is and where, or you lose too much. Of the most important stuff, Justice in the first act, where Kohlhaas is going on and on about how he's going to get justice for the trashing of his car. It's got to be in there. It is venting of angry, ugly feelings about angry, ugly things that have happened. But the thing that I disliked about the full length version of it was that it catered too much to making Kohlhaas not as sympathetic as I think he is. You know, throw the book out the window, the E.L. Doctorow book that it's based on, throw, you know, different people's moral relativism out the window. I don't care. Kohlhaas is the hero of the show. You know, he makes poor decisions, but that describes every hero in the history of major musical theater. I mean, it describes Pippin. It describes everybody. It describes, I wouldn't say the Phantom, but Christine, Phantom of the Opera, who's the hero of Phantom of the Opera. The Phantom of the Opera is a creepy stalker. He is not the hero of that show.
Not the hero.
Yes, it's named after him. He is not a good man. He's a scary, creepy rapist. It's a great part, you know, that doesn't make him good. Kohlhaas makes mistakes, but what would you have him do? You know, we're at a point in this country where other people feel more strongly that there is no rule of law and that everything should be anarchy and we should be torching things. A lot of people feel more strongly about that side of it than I do. But I think that we're at a time and place where we can relate to this stuff more than the whole country has been able to since the civil rights movement in the 60s, since the early aughts of the 20th century, where, you know, there are laws and they're being broken, they're not being enforced, and the promise of the country is being allowed to fall by the wayside. I think there really are people who can go to this show and comprehend it as, oh, well, you know, look at this. They're making this anarchist guy who's burning things down and blowing them up. They're making him out to be some hero, but he's a terrorist. I mean, he's a terrible, horrible person. Well, what would you have people do? What would you have people do who are held captive by their own country and told that their rights are not as equal as other people's rights? What would you have people do that are literally being trampled on, spat on, shot, and abused, other than have them demonstrate against that? I don't think people should be burning down firehouses and threatening to blow up the JP Morgan library. But that's a discovery that Kohlhaas comes to. That is something that he comes to, and that is his redemption arc. That is why he is a good man and a great man. Because even as desperate and as angry as he is, and as much right as he has to be angry, when you get to make them hear you, if you've ever been to a musical, you know which direction things are going for Kohlhaas, and the fact that he is not going to go out unshot. But you know that this is about people taking those feelings of anger, people taking all of that energy and finding a way to preserve the meaning of the country and the promise of the country and the American dream, and find a way to stand up and fight for things that does not involve sacrificing the stability and promise of America on the altar at the same time. You know, I feel like the trimming of different things in the 2009 revival only ends up improving the overall punch of those messages and of the most important aspects of the story. If nothing else, if you've listened through the spoiler section of this and haven't listened to the show and followed along with it, you're doing yourself a disservice. And if you love Hamilton, I don't know how you could not like Ragtime. I cannot fathom how you would not like Ragtime if you like Hamilton. It's not the same kind of show as Hamilton. It doesn't have the same kind of music. Doesn't have the same hook.
I mean, I know we just had a revival in 2009, but the more I think about this, like in a post-Hamilton world, but also in a world that is like that racial issues are so much in the front of people's public consciousness now, and like in a Black Lives Matter world, that I think that if this show came back to Broadway in 2018, that it would be very differently received than it was just 10 years ago.
Yeah. Honestly, I mean, this year, when it comes to premieres and everything, all of that stuff is set and locked and loaded and everything. But I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that a second revival is not being thought of for 2019. Because if this dude makes it all the way through his 4-year term, this show needs to be on Broadway. I mean, when Hamilton came out and people were like, well, so it's like 1776, but hip hop. And I was like, no, I mean, it's historical and it's set around the same time, but they're really nothing at all alike. And I like 1776. Don't get me wrong, but if you're telling people who like Hamilton, oh, check out 1776, they'll be like, oh, it's William Daniels from Boy Meets World. Great, cool, whatever. Nice, yay. No. Hand them Ragtime. If you haven't listened to Ragtime, it's on Amazon Music. If you have Prime, not hard to find. It is. I'm actually, as much time has gone on since the big Hamilton boom hit, I am surprised that more people are not talking about this show. And you know, now that the original cast of Hamilton has cycled out of that show, it is not out of the realm of possibility to imagine Lin-Manuel Miranda playing Tata. Look, enough Jewish men have played Hispanics. I've seen Jewish guys get cast in Hispanic roles before I get cast. So look, it can swing both ways. Let a Puerto Rican play a Latvian immigrant. There's no reason that Leslie Odom Jr. can't play Kohlhaas Walker.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Right?
My heart just sang.
Yeah. And you know who should play Sarah, right? Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the central Skylar sister.
Renee Lee Scolesberry.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The love of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. The love of everyone's lives. Yeah, there's a part for most of the Hamilton cast in Ragtime.
Are you listening, Broadway investors?
It is a crucially important show right now, and the only thing that hurts more than the heartache of listening to the songs over is the notion that there are people out there that don't know this show. Even if I had not been in it, because being in it to the extent that I was, all of us who had, you know, non-lead parts like that, we were as much audience members as the people that were actually sitting in the seats. We were watching most of the show every single time. And it changes you. I am very thoroughly convinced that if I had not been in this show in 2004, that in 2008, I wouldn't have gotten deeply active in the surprisingly important Texas Democratic primary, volunteering for Barack Obama, getting chosen as a delegate at my precinct convention and then my county convention, and then being elected state delegation chair for Williamson County to the Texas State Democratic Convention in 2008, and being a part of the process in a more thrillingly vivid and involved way than I ever had been. I mean, without a candidate like Barack Obama, I wouldn't have done that. And look, this isn't a political show, but anytime I'm on a show, it's suddenly a political show. Without a candidate like Obama, none of us would have been there. But I feel like without having been a part of this show, I would not have been the why do you care? You know, what's the point? What does it matter? Having people say stuff like that to me, because I wasn't getting paid for anything. I wasn't running for anything. I just knew that it was important to stand up and do stuff. And of all things, a musical, with an exploding car, is what I think pushed me in that direction when I was an undergrad. Another weird fun fact. So in the movie that they made of the book, Tata was played by Mandy Patinkin.
Whoa.
And it's amazing to me that Mandy Patinkin, legendary vocalist in his own right, played that part and has never played Tata in the musical, because he would have been perfect. Some might say he still could. He could sing it in concert. Why not? No reason he can't. Who knows? Maybe he has. Maybe I'm that bad of a music theater nerd.
Well, hopefully, at any rate, this podcast has introduced many new people to the show Ragtime and has convinced you to listen to it if you've not listened to it already.
I think I half prepared for your interrogation lightning round questionnaire.
Well, let's start off with, what is your favorite song from the show?
Wheels of a Dream. There's a reason that they come back to it in the closing and the epilogue. I sing the first chunk of it, and there's a duet part, and there's a bit that's Cole House singing stuff to Sarah about the promise of hope and the promise of the future and everything. And the end, the two of them sing together.
Beyond the
makes you feel good about America in a time when America does not make you feel so great, whether you're in it or outside of it. It just, Yeah. It's heartbreaking because you think about the promise of America unfulfilled, and at once restores your hope that is part of what makes the United States so great, is that our system of government has managed to stay so comparatively stable. Not to say that it's perfect.
Well, the next question is, who is your favorite character?
My favorite, well, obviously Harry Houdini, the star of the show, who everything revolves around. Yeah, I mean, I like Houdini. I like Tata. Tata is probably the part I would end up going out for at this point. Even though the genetic benefit to being multi ethnic is that my face basically looks the exact same as when I was 25. So I've had people say that they can't place my age. Either I've always looked about 32 to different people, or I still could play mid-20s for some people. Going back to when I was a teenager, I was playing every 80-year-old man in the theater canon. I was Aegeus in A Midsummer Night's Dream. I was Grandpa Joe in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I played much, much older for the majority of my early career. I was the ethnic kid that people couldn't quite place, who school theater directors would actually say these words, not just one, multiple. You're just not that kind of character. I see you more as a villain.
Ooh.
My high school theater director said that to me. She said that she was going to give Mercutio to this freshman, because she didn't see me as that kind of a character, that I really was more this, like, this greasy John Leguizamo type of thing, and that I'd be so much better as a bad guy. And I was like, okay, thanks, lady. Never been told that before. It's not doing anything to my psyche or anything. There are a bunch of really great characters in the show. If Sarah got to do more, I would say, like, if I'm having to pick one, if Sarah got to do more, it'd be Sarah. She's absolutely got the best songs overall of her own. The show is Cole House's show. He gets to do the most complex, most layered stuff. He gets to have the biggest, broadest, richest journey. He is absolutely, for me, up there in the canon of great characters in the musical theater.
Amazing. I feel like we've already answered the next question, but it's, if you had to recommend this show, who would you recommend go see it?
Everybody, especially racists. Like, just tie them, strap them to a chair, gag them, make them watch it. Especially the people who need to see it the most are the ones who, at face value, are not going to be as amenable to the message. There are people that I know went and saw that production that thought of themselves as, like, gentle Democrats, like just this side of center Democrats, who harbored a bunch of invisible and not so invisible racial prejudices, that this show fundamentally changed them. This is absolutely a show. There are people who will say that about Hamilton, but the loads and loads of white people, no offense, Quinn, you're lovely. You're delightful. The loads and loads of people who love Hamilton, who've actually been changed by it in with respect to, they are out there doing more today than they were the day before they were exposed to and transformed by Hamilton. I really don't think that, like, the transformation matrix is as high. Ragtime is the kind of show that gets you block walking and becoming a voter registrar and getting more people registered to vote and driving people to the polls, on election day. If you need that push, then you need this show just as much as the people whose hearts need to be open to understand why Black Lives Matter in the first place and why the Black Lives Matter movement is important. Even though you may not think that you do, you need this show just as much as the incredibly insanely racist uncle. Have I missed any of your questions? Was the one about would I combine it with something else?
Yeah, my last question is, if you could combine the show with another musical, which one would you pick?
No, I can't even wrap my head around it, because, I mean, this show's already three shows in one.
Yeah,
it's it's, I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot in here.
I mean, we did cross cast it with Hamilton a few minutes ago, so
yeah,
we kind have already done it.
There we go. All right. So good. I met all of the minimum requirements.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being on tonight.
Well, Quinn, everything has its season. Everything has its time. Mm-hmm. Show me a reason and I'll soon show you a rhyme. And that's as much as of Corner of the Sky as I remember off the top of my head.
I know the whole song, but only the alto harmonies because we sing it in choir. Yeah. So yeah. That's where I'm at with Corner of the Sky.
Thank you for having me on. I mean, for the whole story of Ragtime, you should go see Ragtime literally anywhere that it's being put on. You might actually see the very car that was in the production that I was in.
And if you look carefully under one of the pedals, Moises has signed it. No.
I should have. That's actually something we should have done as a cast. We should have all inscribed it somewhere.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find us online at themecompo.com/COTS or follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. If you like, you could also review us in Apple Podcasts or recommend us in Overcast. Until next time, listen for the new music.